BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Unions representing doctors and nurses have expressed concerns about new guidance that allows personal protective equipment to be reused at hospitals in England. It follows a warning from the head of NHS providers that some hospitals could run out of the fluid repellent and long sleeve gowns used to treat coronavirus patients this weekend. The government says it's working round the clock to source extra items. Dr. Rob Harwood from the Doctors' Union, the BMA, says the situation could lead to some members refusing to treat patients.
I don't think any healthcare worker should be expected to expose themselves to potential risks to their lives during the course of their work. It really is an awful position to place people in. I can't imagine the torment that some of our staff are going to go through over this weekend. It is a decision that individuals will have to make, whether they feel they can accept the risk.
The World Health Organization has questioned whether tests for COVID-19 antibodies are of any use. Some countries have planned widespread antibody testing to assist the easing of lockdown restrictions. Dr. Maria van Kerkhove from the WHO said there was no guarantee that strategy would work.
Right now, we have no evidence that the use of a serologic test can show that an individual is immune or is protected from reinfection. What the use of these tests will do will measure the level of antibodies. It's a response that the body has a week or two later after they've been infected with this virus. But that does not mean that somebody with antibodies means that they're immune.
An early release scheme to help prisons in England and Wales cope with the pandemic has been suspended following the accidental release of six ineligible offenders. The prison service has blamed human error and says it's tightening administrative procedures to ensure it doesn't happen again. Council leaders in England have warned the government they need urgent extra funding to tackle the challenges caused by the pandemic. The BBC has seen a letter from the Local Government Association to the Community Secretary, Robert Jenrick, warning that some local authorities may have to take extreme cost-cutting measures to avoid financial failure. Alex Forsyth has more details.
The coronavirus crisis has increased pressure on crucial council services like social care, support for those living with disabilities and the homeless. At the same time, income from parking, leisure and other fees has fallen, and there's fear council tax revenue could drop as people face financial hardship. The government has already announced £1.6 billion of extra funding. Council leaders say while that's welcome, it falls short of what's needed, warning of cuts to vital services now and in future. A government spokesman said the community secretary will support councils to provide services to their communities.
Jeremy Irons, Tilda Swinton and Hilary Mantel will take part in an online recital of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The project will see sections of the 150-verse work broadcast over a number of days.
It's the first time with Sinead O'Connor.
Thank you. and welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. And today's guest was a huge worldwide star in the early 90s, but went on to sidestep mainstream fame to emerge as one of the most outspoken and single-minded artists around, Sinead O'Connor. It was her phenomenally successful cover of Prince's Nothing Compares to You in 1990 that brought Sinead to the attention of the world. But the Dublin-born singer had already established herself as a remarkable vocal talent, and one that wasn't going to conform to anyone's preconceptions of what a female pop star should look like or how she should behave. She went on to use her fame as a platform to express her views on women's rights, child abuse and organised religion, famously ripping up a photo of Pope John Paul II live on US TV. But she also released a series of diverse and acclaimed albums, taking in everything from jazz standards to folk and from country and western to show tunes. Here Sinead chats about her formative years, her passions for Bowie, Dylan, Lennon and Elvis, and two of her favourite subjects, Rastafarianism and reggae. She also recalls the media furore that surrounded her success, including her recent battles with mental illness. And I started by asking Sinead, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
One of my very earliest memories as a baby, and I can remember a fair bit from being a small baby, is John Lennon. And the thing was, I didn't discover it was John Lennon until I was older and I saw him on telly, but I remember being a tiny baby. Tiny babies experience the world mostly through their ears, you know, they can't see much, do you know what I mean? And my mother was very into music and into John Lennon. And I remember hearing this voice a lot before I became conscious, really, of anything else in the world. Do you know what I mean? Was this voice, this kind of disembodied voice. But it wasn't until I got to kind of, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 that I began to put a body to the voice and see that it was an actual person. Before that, I thought it was just this kind of disembodied being that used to sing around my ears, you know.
What were the tracks that you can remember?
Well, she was particularly into, it was Shaved Fish, I remember, had come out. I believe it was called Shaved Fish, because I remember thinking it was a very odd title. And there was also the Plastic Ono album, you know, she had an 8-track machine. So this was in the days when there was 8-track. But my mother, she had a very eclectic musical taste, my mother. But yeah, the first artist I heard ever, yeah, was John Lennon. And in fact, it's probably my earliest memory as a child altogether is John Lennon, but not knowing it was a person. Temperature's rising, fever is high, can't see no future,
from playing music, was it a musical household? You know, would you call it a
yeah,
musical
very,
upbringing?
Yeah, very, very, yeah. My mother and father were both extremely musical in different ways, but they did kind of come together when it came to, they both sang in like light operas and all those terribly awful things. So they had all of those and they had all those albums. But then my father is more limited in his taste. He's just kind of strictly classical, you know. And whereas my mother had a very broad range of tastes. Like she was into anything from Johnny Cash and John Lennon all right the way through to Porgy and Bess was a big album when we were kids. She was mad into musicals as well, so there was Fiddler on the Roof and there was all these other crazy musicals, Oklahoma and all this stuff. And then there was was, you know, opera singers and all of that kind of stuff. So my mother in particular, and in fact, even on the, we used to have this big dark oak kind of table, and the record collection was always spread out right across the table, which must have been about 12 foot long, like, but all day, every day there was this kind of collection, you know. But I also had an aunt who was my mother's sister, who when, at the time when I would have been about 6, 7, 8, 9-ish, she was 16. And she actually had Down syndrome, but she was no different to any other 16-year-old in that she was addicted to music, and she had managed to scab her father's record player off him, you know, and she just lived up in the bedroom like every other 16-year-old with her record player. And she used to call me up. I stayed at my granny's a lot when I was a kid, you know. And Frances, my aunt, I think was the person who I would credit really with getting me interested in music, because she just locked me in the room all day, and she was in love, of course, with all the singers, do you know what I mean? And she'd make you look at them all and go, isn't he lovely, isn't he lovely? And you'd have to agree he was lovely, which of course he wasn't when you were 6 or 7, but he was when you were 16. But she did this thing with me, which I've to this day always do with my children, and I do with any albums. She would make me read every single word inside and outside on the record sleeve. Even though I was only 6, I couldn't understand it. She'd be poking me in the head if I stopped reading it, you know. And she would make me touch the sleeves and touch the photos and all. Partly because she was Down syndrome, so she had this very thing about the sensuality and the touching of stuff, do you know. But I thought that was a fantastic way to experience records as well as listening to them, you know, that you valued how they had made it look. So yeah, that always stuck with me. I kind of still do that. I you know, can't really listen to a record at all without studying in great detail the innards and outards of the sleeve and looking at the person for hours and put them on my wall and look at them and wonder who they are and all that stuff, you know. So, and she herself, of course, had quite eclectic taste, because she was into this terrible singer called Danny Doyle, this Irish guy who was just awful. Oh my God. Oh, I remember Alvin Stardust. I was mad into Alvin Stardust. she got me into him as well. He had this record, Cuckoo Cachoo. We loved that record.
What was the first record that belonged to you that you went out and chose?
It was an Elvis record, which I got when I was about 8, and it was actually a French double album of Elvis called Le Rie du Rock and Roll.
It's a good title.
Yeah, and it was I liked black leather Elvis. You know, I was freaked out by opera Elvis later. I didn't get that. I was like, who is that person who's taken over Elvis? You know what I mean? But I liked jailhouse rock Elvis, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was all from, the songs were all from that phase, you know. I was addicted to all those terrible Elvis movies and everything. I loved them even though they were awful. And I hate to admit that I did love them, but I did. Especially the one where he was Deke Winters, I can't remember what it was called.
It's a great name.
Yeah. And he took it off a grave and all this kind of stuff. So there was some great songs in the movies. And then he was just so fascinating to watch. I never fancied him or anything, but and you could observe he was beautiful, but he was far too beautiful to fancy. He was beyond sexuality, really. He was so beautiful. But
like an otherworldly being.
Yeah, but I was always fascinated to watch him as a singer, just how he was as a singer, because he never... I'm interested in singers who don't seem to switch from speaking to singing. It's all animated speaking. And was quite ahead of his time in it, because he was kind of always doing a lot of the twitching around the place anyway, even when he wasn't speaking, you know. So I find him quite fascinating to watch.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why. Oh,
sometime. Strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why, oh why, oh why won't that sun appear?
When you first started writing songs, who did you start? Who were your heroes? Who were your musical obsessions?
Well, by then, Bob Dylan had really become my obsession. I was first exposed to Bob Dylan really when my brother Joseph, who's 3 years older than me, came home in 1978 with Slow Train Coming. And we had in Ireland at that time a theocracy, really. It was a very religious kind of country, and unfortunately it was infected with the worst kind of religious music that you could possibly imagine, you know. And it was the kind of music that really you'd feel sorry for God having to listen to it, you know. It was all very kind of charismatic, kind of kumbaya kind of music. So we were, some of us, the younger generation, we were quite religious as such. We were quite not religious in that we weren't into the isms and ists, but we were holy, or we like to consider ourselves holy anyway. We believed in God, you know, but we were just mortified by this music, you know, and we couldn't get involved in it because it was just the uncoolest people. Like, the only people in the country who wore Aran jumpers were the ones making these records. And it's just like the uncoolest people on earth basically was making religious music. And although we might have sort of been in the closet and wanted to be able to make religious music, we just couldn't contemplate it because we didn't want to be like these people, you know. But then what happened was my brother came home with Slow Train Coming, and it just completely changed my life and set entirely the course of the rest of my life and career and everything I wanted to be as a person and an artist and everything. But what was wonderful about it was because we saw Bob Dylan as, in one way, you know, this quite prophetic kind of angelic being that's similar to John Lennon, the kind of person who, I always say I include people like Muhammad Ali in this, even though he's not an artist, but there are certain people in the world where when you look at them, you know there's a God. It doesn't matter, or a spirit world, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't matter what they say or do or wear or anything else. It's actually how they look and just their presence and something about them, you know. And there was something for us about that with Bob Dylan. But what was wonderful for us as the Irish kids with Bob Dylan, and why we listened to his religious music, we were moved by it, was because he was this very flawed character. And even the sound of his voice was quite flawed. You know, he was crackly and he wore filthy clothes and, you know, he smoked and he was grumpy and, you know, that kind of way. He wasn't at all goody-goody. And not only that, but the religious music he was making was funky and sexy and cool, you know. And you were like, oh my God, it must be so cool being God listening to that, you know. So I was just addicted to him, obsessed with him. I never listened to anybody else for years, you know what I mean? Like, definitely entire tracts of childhood and early teenage that I just would not have survived without, you know, Slow Train Coming. Then Desire was a big record for me. I'm a bit, I'm still like this with Bob Dylan. I have one iPod that's just Bob Dylan, that's all that's on it. And I have another which is just Curtis Mayfield, who we get into later. But I can't, if I start listening to Bob Dylan, I can't stop for a year. I can barely listen to anybody else, you know, that way. So I was like that even when I was a teenager. So I remember discovering the album Desire and just not listening to anything else for probably about 2 years ever. And then I remember waiting and waiting and waiting for Infidels, you know. And I remember my English teacher begging, could he borrow it? We were all waiting for Infidels for like 6 months before it came out. And so Bob really was the one.
If we've got to play a Bob track, which track should it be? Difficult choice.
Terribly hard to choose. I hate having to choose it. It makes me physically sore. Often.
Sorry.
People often ask me that, and it's terribly hard to choose because you fall in love with different Bob Dylan songs. I think at the moment the one I'm desperately in love with is, there are two versions of this, so it can't be the one from the bootleg album. It has to be from the Greatest Hits Volume 2, which is a blue cover. He's got on a denim jacket. It's Tomorrow is a Long Time. Really gorgeous song that he wrote when he was about 20, when his girlfriend had gone to Italy for a summer, and he was miserable without her, you know, and he wrote just this absolutely gorgeous love song that you couldn't believe would come out the mouth of a 20-year-old man. Like,
if today was not a crooked highway, if tonight was not a crooked trail, if tomorrow wasn't such a long time, then lonesome would mean nothing to you at all. Yes, and only if my own true love was waiting, if I could hear her heart is softly pounding. Yes, and only if she was lying by me. And I'd lie in my bed once again. I can't see my reflection in the water. I can't speak the sounds to show no pain. I can't hear the echo of my footsteps or remember the sounds of my own name. Yes, and only if my own true love was waiting, and if I could only hear her heart a softly pounding. Yes, and only if she was lying by me, that I'd lie in my bed once again. There's beauty in that silver singing river. There's beauty in that rainbow in the sky. But none of these and nothing else can touch the beauty that I remember in my true love's eyes. Yes, and only if my own true love was waiting, if I could only hear her heart is softly pounding. Yes, and only if she was lying by me, and I'd lie in my bed once again.
So it's beautiful. But then alongside him, now he was, you know, God, but then alongside him there were others, like there was David Bowie was a huge one. I remember seeing David Bowie on Mark Boland's TV show, the first time David Bowie was on telly in England. I remember distinctly being a very small child seeing it and just being blown away. I loved Mark Boland as well, but obviously, look, he just didn't have the kind of gravitas that people like David Bowie had, you know, in terms of what to write. David Bowie was just like a creature from another universe. And the sound of his voice. Now, in Ireland, they were inclined not to publish a lot of his interviews because he was talking about controversial matters way ahead of his time, particularly bisexuality. He was talking about that back in the early 70s. He was saying he was bisexual. Mm. And I remember we'd be asking our parents, what's a bisexual? And we'd be told, be quiet, have your crisps. And, you know, so they were inclined to shut him down in terms of they didn't want to print his interviews, but they did show his music. They couldn't, you can't stop music, you know. But in Ireland, again, you know, we were a culture at that time where the biggest flipping thing, it was awful. I mean, apart from the terrible religious music, it was this terrible Irish country and Western bands. It was awful, really. It was a hell on earth, like. I mean, we're all in therapy for years trying to recover from the music, really. You know, Gina Dale Hayes and the Champions, these kind of bands. And this was all you heard in the charts, you know. So very rarely something would break through. And so when David Bowie came along, we were like, oh, my God, this is just so cool, you know. And he had on the makeup and the whole thing. And but I was fascinated with him as a singer. I just loved how he used his voice. And I found, without meaning it to be the case, that when I go back now and I listen to my first record, I can see certain areas in which I probably stole the odd just little phrasings and things like from him. He did this thing where obviously his lyrics were fantastic and what he was saying, but he often made these noises with his voice. He would say a word and then at the end of it would be a kind of you know, the way he would use a word, you know. Even if it was just spiders from Ma-ha-ha's, well, to us that was a huge thing, you know, because in Ireland all we was used to was spiders from Mellors. You know? Nobody ever thought of saying anything interestingly. And they certainly didn't say it with a whole lot of makeup on and one green eye and one blue eye and telling everyone they like to have sex with men and women, you know what I mean?
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung snow white tan.
time, jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass, he was the Nas with God-given ass. He took it all too far, but boy, could he play guitar.
So people like David Bowie were very important to us, but not just obviously because he was such a space cadet and so different, but he was just so musically off the scale. Like, do you know what I mean?
You mentioned your first album. A big first for any musician is their first single. Your first official single under your name was Troy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What do you remember about the reaction to that coming out?
Well, the funniest part I remember was that it went to number one in Holland, which I thought was the funniest thing ever. I just thought it was hilarious. Well, I just thought that the song at all would go to number one anywhere, A, because it was about 25 minutes long. Well, it's not that long, really. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's a very, very long song. It must be about 10 minutes. And it doesn't really have, you know, verse, chorus, and it's quite heavy. So it was an education about Holland, really, more than anything else. What stuck with me over it all was, geez, I must go to Holland. You know?
I remember it in Dublin in a rainstorm, sitting in the long grass in summer, keeping warm. I remember it every rest night. We were so young then, we thought that everything we could possibly do was right. And we moved, stolen from our very eyes. And I wondered where you went to. And tell me, when did the light die? You'll return, let me be the phoenix from the flame. You will learn to rise. You'll return, be what you are.
The phoenix from the flame.
That was Troy, Sinead O'Connor's first single from 1987, and you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Sinead O'Connor. One of Sinead's biggest influences has always been soul legend Curtis Mayfield. I asked her when she first became aware of his music.
Well, again, now, when I was a small child, there was the odd straggler. A couple of miracles happened that would have changed the course of my life. So before, first, there was a Slow Train coming and my brother coming on with that. But previous to that, there were a few what I would call stragglers that broke out of the British charts into the Irish charts, where the Irish charts were all full of these awful country and western covers. But by some miracle, it was at the time that Desmond Dekker's song The Israelites went to number one. And around the same time, probably before that, was Toots and the Maytals, 54-46. These branched out over to Ireland, which is unheard of. So I could hear these two Jamaican guys scream and shout, and they were two very different guys, and this is how I began my love of Jamaican music in relationship with Rasta music in particular, even though they weren't overtly Rasta tunes. And then of course there was later Althea and Donna, you know, Uptown Top Rank, and that was all before I left Ireland. When I came to London, then I got involved with Rasta people.
See me in my heels and ting, them checks how we hip and ting, to them no know and ting, we have them going and ting. Now pop no style, I strictly roots. Now pop no style, I strictly roots. See me on the road and you no call out to me. Do you see me in my pants and tee? See me in my altar back. See me give you heart attack. Give me little bass, make me wine up my waist. Uptown Top Ranking.
What was wonderful, again, when you listen to Toots, he was like this big child, and it was a very great defiance in what he was saying. He was taking this quite heavy thing that had happened to him and making something quite defiant out of it, and there was something quite beautifully cheeky and childish about what he was saying, the fact that he was, and even the way he was singing it, celebrating 54-46 was my number. Those were big influences. I don't know why, but there was just something Irish people would tell you, or often people would tell you about Irish music and singing in particular, that there's a calling in Irish voices, a certain yearning, if you like, you know. But I think Toots had a similar, I don't know that he had a yearning, but he had this great calling in his voice, and in a way that's what reached out right across the Atlantic and even landed in Irish houses. Even now I love him. I don't necessarily always like his lyrics, and I don't necessarily always like the song, but I don't care, because it's him. I just love him. His personality just reaches right across. It was him, and then there was Desmond Dekker. He had this different type of voice. It had this calling in it, but it was more sad. There was much more of a sadness in it, and again, I don't know how he did it, but something in his sadness really tapped into ours, and it reached into Ireland in a way that other records, it was just unheard of. Nobody played black music in Ireland. And even after that, it took a very long time for black people to have their music played in Ireland.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelite, sir. Up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Oh, me Israelite.
Wipe on my kids, step back up and leave me. Darling, she said I was yours to receive.
Oh, me Israelite.
Shut them a tear up, chose his ago. I don't want to end up like Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, me Israelite.
After
hear a storm, they must be a coming. But catch me in a palm, you sound your alarm.
Yeah, I'd say it started, say there's John Lennon, then there'd be Desmond Dekker, and there'd be David Bowie, and there'd be Toots, and then Bob Dylan. And then I moved to London and got involved with the Rasta movement here, Rasta people here, you know, and began to be exposed to not just reggae music, but my love in particular was the Rasta element of reggae music, you know, obviously having come from a, you know, the theocracy that I'd grown up in. And these people, I found, had a terribly mischievous attitude towards Catholicism, which I really admired, you know, because we in Ireland, we were terrified to ever say a word about it. And these guys were making records, like, vampire blood and all this kind of stuff. And now I just thought, oh my God, they're the coolest people on earth. My experience of the theocracy was how a theocracy works is it dictates to you what the Bible says. And it makes sure that you're too busy feeding yourself to try and find out for yourself what the Bible says. But what I loved about the Rasta guys is that they were taking scriptures and putting them into records, so that suddenly I began to learn a whole load of scriptures I never heard before, do you know what I mean? And they gave me this whole interest in, you know, learning the Bible, and I learned a whole load of scriptures that I never would have learned otherwise. And I began to have then this very passionate, lifelong then interest in actually unravelling what is in this book that these people have misinterpreted in order to oppress my people.
What would be a song that would best illustrate that?
My favourite was the Fire for the Vatican, the Max Romeo tune. I think it's Max Romeo sings it, Fire for the Vatican. He also does another one which I love, is Iron Shirt. You know, I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of her. Those I love because they're just so childlike, as well as being really mischievous. Because in Ireland, obviously, you'd grew up in this theocracy, and you wouldn't, I mean, if a priest told you black was white, you would agree that black was whiter than white, you know what I mean? And so for these guys to come along and say anything bad about the priest was just hilarious, was just so mischievous.
We are doing first, and we have to talk about your first massive international hit. We have to talk about Nothing Compares to You. What is your relationship like with that song now?
I love it. I love the song. People always imagine that I must be sick of it, because I suppose some people do get sick of their hit. No, I love it. I never sing a song that I can't emotionally identify with, just because of the whole way that I studied singing, the whole way I've been brought up to sing all my life. It's really about emotions. It's not about notes. The minute you start thinking about the notes, you may as well pack up and go home. So I never sing a song that I can't emotionally identify with. So there are plenty of previous songs that I don't do, but I always do that one, and without doubt every single night I kind of do it's like the Stanislavski method of singing. It's called bel canto, the manner of singing that I've studied, but it's a bit like the Stanislavski acting method. You know, you have to find emotional stuff inside yourself that you can use.
And then channel that into the performance.
Yeah, and I mean, 30 years later, you've got to be able to sing the same damn song every damn night and find something inside yourself emotionally to identify with. But I'm always able to find it, and it's always the same thing, and it always works no matter what, every single night for however many years. I always think of my mother when I'm thinking of that song, which is why I had the little tear in the video, or you name it. Anyway, my mother died when I was 17, and it wasn't long after that I was making the video or the song, you know. And in that, I think I'm probably similar to millions of people who love the song, and that, you know, we're all people who associate the song with a loss of some kind, you know, whether it's a breakup or whatever, you know. And so still when I sing it, I think about my mother, but I don't get sad about it. But what I think is that I'm talking to my mother. That's my little minute that I spend with my mother, just letting my mother know that I'm thinking of her and I love her, you know, that kind of ways. So it's nice. I'm always able to go there emotionally, but without crying, because you've got to ride the fine line, so you don't want to get sad, obviously. But at the same time, I invoke my mother, because that's who I'm singing about.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. Can take away those blues, 'cause nothing comes.
I'm fascinated in what it must be like to be not just the voice, but as you, I mean, you mentioned the video, the face as well, because sometimes songs become more than just pop songs and they become
yes.
cultural moments, and then you're in the centre of this whirlwind of attention, this enormous international thing. How does that feel?
Weird.
How did you cope with it?
It's very confusing, really. Mm. I think just by smoking a lot of weed, really. And I don't know that I ever have coped with it, to be honest, or did. I found it kind of weird. There was good things about it, but I was so young, and I mean, I at that age, you don't really have a strong sense of your own identity anyway. Mm. And then because of how I had grown up in Ireland, I really had a bit of an identity crisis anyway. So it was all a bit of a massive identity crisis. But there was great things about it. I mean, all my dreams was coming true in terms of what job I wanted to do. You know, I was going to make a living being a singer, which was great because I couldn't do anything else. And I was headed down sort of a petty criminal path before that. And if I hadn't got rescued by music and that, I probably could have ended up in a bit of trouble. So that was all quite good. But then you see, you're suddenly on this conveyor belt, but it's other people is taking you along this track and this journey of what they want you to be and what they want you to do. They want you to be a pop star, and they want you to not say this or to say that or to wear this or to not wear that. And you stop seeing yourself reflected back at you in anyone that you know. You know, suddenly everyone is not around you who knew you before. It's a bit like I always say, people are like mirrors. Our friends and family are like mirrors, aren't they? We see ourselves in them. You know, if you don't have them, suddenly you've got all these new people who are not reflecting back at you who you really are, but more what they want you to be. And you don't realise, of course, what they want you to do is pay their mortgage. So when they're saying to you, you know, would you like me to run down to so-and-so and get so-and-so for you? You think they're being really nice and everything, but no, they're not.
In 1992, I Am Not Your Girl, if you were going to take a conventional fame route, what you shouldn't do is release an album of jazz standards. Mm. That's what you did.
I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone.
When did your love affair with that style of music, that genre of music?
Well, it was part of the culture in Ireland when I was growing up. It was all musicals on telly. We were quite backward TV wise as well. We only had two channels. We didn't have English channels. We only had RTE and RTE1, RTE2 Irish channels. Very rarely would you have a house that had BBC, and you really wouldn't go in there given the political situation. It was not cool to watch BBC, and you couldn't be interested in English kids shows even. So the entertainment on TV was mostly musicals, American musicals, you know, and so it was all Doris Day and it was all those kinds. So I was reared on those, and my mother, of course, was addicted to them, you know, that she had all the soundtracks. But really the reason I made that record, it was a bit of a red herring. I mean, I loved the songs, so I wasn't entirely being disingenuous. I teach singing now, and I always say there's only one reason you should ever make a record, and that's because you're going to go insane. It shouldn't be because you're thinking of any other outcome. And all the best records throughout history, that's the reason they were made. So I wasn't comfortable that I had then woken up one day being a pop star, you know, it didn't suit my personality and I didn't suit it and it didn't suit me, and it was a very unhappy relationship, me and the pop star world. So I didn't want to follow along that path, and I didn't want to fall into that trap then of, you know, the follow-up album to the number one single. So I was kind of buying myself some time, really, creatively speaking, you know. So then to me, Universal Mother was actually the follow-up record. So I was amazed I got away with them. I couldn't believe the record company let me do it, but that's how stupid it was. Because you've had the hit record, all of a sudden you could go in there and tell them you want to make a record of farts and they'll say, yeah, sure, okay, you know. But still, I did love the record and I loved making it. Just astonishing being in a room with that band every day. It was just like, oh my God. I was quite intimidated, actually. I was quite scared to open my mouth because the band were just so ridiculously brilliant. I couldn't see myself as being anyway good. Like some other men.
Can I ask you about Saturday Night Live?
Mm.
Basically, what seemed to happen was you did a Bob Marley cover, a beautiful rendition of a Bob Marley song on Saturday Night Live, big American TV show. During the song, end of the song, took a picture of the Pope, and then it seemed you were, for many people, evil incarnate.
Mm.
The most awful woman that had ever stalked the earth.
And I was wearing Sade's dress. She may not know this, but when I came to England in 1985, I didn't put out my first record in 1987, but I moved to England in 1985 and I went to a rock and roll auction and I bought a dress for £800 that used to belong to Sade. It was one of Sade's famous white lace dresses and I was wearing it on Saturday Night Live, and my daughter now has it and she's going to wear it for her wedding dress.
Nice.
So I've said to my daughter, this is a dress for women to cause trouble in. Of course, Shadi, of course, is a lady and behaves herself at all times, but she still was an inspiration to me. I used to love her. She was just so powerful but so silent and gentle, which I could never be.
What do you remember from the fallout of that? Looking back, it's quite staggering the amount of waves it caused, both in the media, especially in America. And a few artists kind of stood behind you and lots of artists didn't. What do you remember from that time?
I don't really remember anything except for one funny thing I remember was when we came out of NBC, myself and a girlfriend of mine were there, and a bunch of young fellas are waiting for us. Now, what they didn't realise, myself and my friend Kira at school, we were the top sprinters at school, right? We could do 100 metres in 11.2, the two of us both. We were enemies but friends as sprinters, you know. So these two decided to collar us outside of NBC Studios, young guys, you know, threw a load of eggs at us and thinking we'd be scared, but two of us ran after them and caught them, and we collared about three of these guys in the corner of some alleyway and just made them apologise, basically. But by the end, they're like, we're really sorry, we're very sorry, we understand now. And that was the end, we just got in the cab and went home.
You did sing a Bob Marley song. You love Bob Marley.
Yeah.
What's a song that we should play that kind of sums up all that you love about him as an artist?
Small Axe.
Why that song?
Small Axe. Because to me, what I love about the Rastas is that they use music as a priesthood and they have an enormous belief in chipping away slowly. Obviously, you know, they have this thing about chant down Babylon, and they have this thing about, you know, if you're a big tree, we're a small axe. And I like the thing of just chipping away slowly, slowly chipping away. You don't have to be dramatic, like, of course, you know, I don't do things slowly. I wish I did, but I admire these people because they're very patient, just chip away slowly. They believe it could take 1,000 years to chant down Babylon, but you just will if you keep chanting. And it's a quick, short, sweet song, and it talks about, you know, his religious thing as well as his defiance, if you like, but also it's just a fantastic verse, chorus, you couldn't write better. It's all taken from a psalm, I can't remember which psalm it is. People know him more for his love songs, the most obvious pop songs. The songs I love him for are the more hardcore Rasta ones, where he's taken scriptures and just made some of the most beautiful songs out of scriptures, and I always appreciate that, obviously, having come from theocracy.
But the tell you that we are the small axe, sharp and ready, ready to cut you down.
Last year there was this utter furore, utter chaos surrounding
Me advertising for a boyfriend.
Well, stuff, yeah, that, which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah,
and people didn't seem to get the joke. And then about your kind of mental state. Do you regret being so honest in public?
Oh, I don't. Look, God didn't make more than one of us for nothing. We're here to communicate with each other. So I don't have any problem with doing what God put us on earth to do. Do you know what I mean? We're here to help each other and talk to each other, like, you know.
People just seem to kind of miss out on some of the humour of some of those, I think, as well.
Yeah, but that's just some people that, you know, want to cause trouble. Do you know what I mean? But you can't let that stop you being you, like, you know.
The final thing is we have to choose a final song, a song to finish on. It would be appropriate, maybe, if it was something from the record. Or it
I'd actually prefer, if I may, my manager will kill me for this, but there's a Curtis Mayfield song. Curtis Mayfield's my other big hero. I didn't discover him or Bob Marley until I was about 20, actually. Well, Bob Marley probably was 17. I never came across Curtis till I was about 20. But my favourite song ever in the world, I love obviously Christian songs or songs about God, but my favourite song ever about Jesus is a Curtis Mayfield song called Jesus, which is on an album called There's No Place Like America Today. And it's actually kind of longish, but hopefully you play it anyway. That would be what I would choose, yeah. It's beautiful.
Maybe the words I say is just another way to pray. I don't know. Think that I'm innocent, cause I can't do nothing for you. I only asked of you just as I got to do myself. Look into your inner self. Only you know how to be free. If you want to grin, let a smile. Feel a little happy, go on, dance a while. Can't nobody play down God's loving child. Cause when the Spirit hits you, you got to move. And just as he made us one of many, then aren't the many of us maybe only one? Surely can he be the rising sun, the depth of night, the light for sight? Sort of sets the moral standards of soul. Gives you the strength to pay the price of life. And rewards you with a bit of fulfillment. The definition of true. He is more real than you, isn't he?
Oh, Maggie Doctor must have been a heavenly man. Jesus, light of inspiration all over this land. Jesus, spite of your fears, you can shed happy tears. Jesus, don't care what you call him, none can befall him. Hear me say amen.
Amen, amen.
Hear me say amen.
Amen, amen.
Now stand up and clap your hands. A traveling soul, the way the story goes. We all know he was crucified, but what he gave us never will die. He never had a hustling man
doing crime, wasting time,
drinking that wine,
drinking that wine,
drinking and a drinking. Because of undying news you hear.
Talk about Jesus. Talk about Jesus.
Strength in time, new temptation. Don't wanna lose a love relation.
Talk about Jesus. Talk about Jesus.
He never had a hustling man.
Time.
Drinking that wine,
drinking that wine.
my children hungry, I'd rather go to my grave, Jesus. The loving way of life has terribly been arranged, Jesus. Something's mighty wrong, and it seems awful strange. Just like a backup gear, there are those in fear of falling in. We who are already here.
This is Radio 2. On the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker, and on 88 to 91 FM.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Justine Green. The doctors union, the BMA, has warned of the dire situation medics are facing after the head of NHS providers says hospitals in England could run out of some personal protective equipment this weekend. New guidance suggests in extreme circumstances the single-use long-sleeve gowns could be reused when treating coronavirus patients. Here's our health correspondent Jane Draper.
The warning has come from the head of NHS providers, Chris Hopson, who represents trusts providing care across England. In a tweet, he said, "We have now reached the point where the national stock of fully fluid repellent gowns will be exhausted in the next 24 to 48 hours. He added that national leaders have left no stone unturned, but gowns that were ordered weeks ago are currently only arriving in fits and starts. BBC News reported last week that Public Health England was planning to suggest the reuse of protective gowns as a last resort, and this guidance has now been issued.
The World Health Organization has questioned whether tests for COVID-19 antibodies will be of any use. WHO officials in Geneva said there was no evidence that having had the virus would guarantee immunity. Some countries have planned widespread antibody testing, suggesting that people who are proven to have immunity would be able to return to work. Dr. Mike Ryan from the WHO has doubts.
There's been an expectation maybe that herd immunity may have been achieved and that the majority of people in society may already have developed antibodies. I think the general evidence is pointing against that and pointing towards a much lower seroprevalence, so it may not solve the problem that governments are trying to solve.
A scheme to release prisoners early to help jails in England and Wales deal with the coronavirus outbreak has been suspended after six offenders were freed by mistake. The prison service has blamed human error and says it's tightening procedures. Council leaders in England have warned the government they need urgent extra funding to tackle the challenges caused by the pandemic. The BBC has seen a letter from the local government association warning that some local authorities may have to take extreme cost-cutting measures to avoid financial failure. Sir Philip Green's Arcadia Group has given notice to its landlords that it could walk away from more than 100 stores by the end of the summer. The fashion group, which includes Topshop, Dorothy Perkins and Miss Selfridge, has 550 outlets across the UK. All are temporarily shut because of the lockdown restrictions. Captain Tom Moore, the 99-year-old war veteran who's been fundraising for the NHS, has now raised more than £21 million. His daughter says it's given her father a renewed sense of purpose.
What this has given him, it's re-energised him. So as much as people feel he's giving to them, he's received so much back in terms of usefulness and purposefulness. And he's totally engaged. And
BBC